Smokey. Roll them.
Hello, and welcome to the 20th episode of Tooncast, brought to you by the Geekcast Radio Network. I am your host, TFG1 Mike, and today I am joined by Ron Algar-Watt and Matt Robotham. Hello, guys.
Hey there.
Hey, hey.
So, how are you guys?
Pretty good. We're good.
Good is, I think,
what we are. Sorry, I got nothing. I saw the microphone and froze up. We're good. Podcast, what's that?
We're wonderful.
Yeah, it's a good thing this isn't an actual radio station.
What a dead air.
Crickets. In the 20th episode, we're going to be talking about Looney Tunes, something that is very near and dear to my heart, and I know that you, Algar, are a fan of as well.
Yes, absolutely. Not sure how much
of a fan of Looney Tunes are you, Matt? Because
I certainly watched it when I was growing up. I didn't really have the huge connection that apparently you guys both did. But I mean, you know, it's just something that is always on TV at some point or another. And I just would, when it was on, I would watch it.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, very much so. So why don't you each introduce yourselves to our audience? Because this is the first time you've been on our show. Algar, you can go first.
Okay. Well, Algar is a pretend name, but that is how I prefer to be addressed. I thank you for that. I do all kinds of crap on the internet. I do reviews of the Transformers, which apparently never... I remember as a kid this show only lasted a few years, but apparently it never ended because I'm still doing these reviews something like 20 years later. Well, what else? Oh, we do a podcast called the Sarcastic Voyage Podcast, Matt and I. We've done webcomics together. We've done, I don't know, I'm pretty sure I've done just about everything, and no one really seems to look at any of it. But that's me.
Yeah. And Matt?
My name is Matt Robotham. I do Sarcastic Voyage with Al. Well, trying not to actually do any of the actual work. I've also worked on the our webcomic, Menace of the Intermen, and the comic that followed it. Other than that, I haven't really done a whole lot.
Well, here's hoping that'll change in the future. So, I think... I don't think we really have any other general chat things we want to mention. I guess I should mention a few programming notes. I am currently... unless you guys want to do it, I'm currently looking for a co-host next week. For the Jetsons and the Flintstones.
We're pretty booked up, actually, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I unfortunately, as far as the Jetsons go, I basically would just be screaming and ranting, and you don't want that. I could talk Flintstones all day long, but when it comes to the Jetsons, no thanks.
Actually, the only reason why I'm putting the two shows together is because of the movie, The Jetsons Meet the Flintstones.
Sure.
This is the only one I really, really could watch over and over and over again.
Yeah.
The rest of it, nah, whatever.
I just remember that Simpsons reference where they had the critic on, and he's like, oh, great, another stupid cartoon crossover.
Hi, meet Jay Sherman, the critic.
Bart Simpson, meet Jay Sherman, the critic.
Incidentally, on our podcast, we have forbidden ourselves to make Simpsons references, but now that we're on your show, we can just talk about
Yeah,
Simpsons.
That kicked that floodgate wide open.
Yeah, so you might want us to talk about Looney Tunes, but really just Simpsons. Donuts. Thank you.
It's funny, I write books of poetry. I have 3 books of poetry published, and I wrote this. I wrote this one poem based on dough.
Very nice.
So yeah, at least it's not tuna felt.
The less said about that, the better, I think.
Yeah, the great felt wars are over. All right, we are gonna
never forget the great felt wars.
Never remember them either.
All right, we are gonna get into the history lesson. We'll be right back.
It's inconceivable!
Cut. No, don't cut. Let the cameras roll and record it for posterity whilst I give this 2-bit Nimrod a severe dressing down. Sir, you have desecrated the spirit of show business make-believe by using real bullets. Cut. No, don't cut. Now get rid of this stupid thing, take your little prop gun, and stick to the script.
Cut.
No, don't cut. And another thing, expect a call from my attorneys about this unfortunate incident. And brother, when they call, you'd better...
we cut? You smug son of a...
It is now time for the history lesson, and for episode 20, we travel back to the 1930s to the 1960s with Looney Tunes. Looney Tunes is a Warner Brothers animated cartoon series which ran in many movie theaters from 1930 to 1969. It preceded the Merry Melodies series and is Warner Brothers' first animated theatrical series. The regular Warner Brothers animation cast also became known as the Looney Tunes, often misspelled intentionally or not as Looney T-O-O-N-S. The name Looney Tunes is a variation on Silly Symphonies, the name of Walt Disney's concurrent series of music-based cartoon shorts. Looney Tunes originally showcased Warner-owned musical compositions through adventures of cartoon characters such as Bosco and Buddy. Later Looney Tunes shorts featured popular characters such as Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, Porky Pig, Elmer Fudd, Sylvester Tweety, Marvin the Martian, Taz, Wile E. Coyote, and the Roadrunner, Foghorn Leghorn, Yosemite Sam, Pepe Le Pew, Speedy Gonzales, and many more. Originally produced by Harmon/Ising Pictures, Looney Tunes was produced by Leon Schlesinger Productions from 1933 to 1944. Schlesinger sold his studio to Warner Brothers in 1944. The newly renamed Warner Brothers cartoons continued production until 1963. Looney Tunes were outsourced to DuPatty and Freeling Enterprises from 64 to 67, and Warner Brothers cartoons reassumed production for the series' final 2 years from 1942 to the 1960s. Looney Tunes was the most popular short cartoon series in theaters, exceeding Disney and other popular competitors. That is the history lesson. We're going to be moving on to the general memories. I didn't realize when I was a kid that these things are, like, before I was even born. I thought they were running concurrent as I'm growing up in the 80s.
Yeah, I would say it's to their credit that they wrote sort of timeless gags. I mean, there's some current pop culture references in there, but for the most part, they wrote some very... I mean, you can appreciate Bugs Bunny in a dress in 2009 just like you could in 1949. I mean, that's, you know...
Yeah, very, very much so. Just great characters. Some of the team-ups and some of the hero-slash-villain team, you know, mashups like Sylvester and Tweety or Daffy Duck and Speedy Gonzales, and then later Daffy Speedy Gonzales and Sylvester. You know, some of the, just the characters are really just pretty much timeless, like you said. I mean, you could show these majority of these cartoons to anyone, and they're going to laugh their ass off.
And it's interesting because I've read a bit on, like, I know one particular director above all, and I'm sure you'll come to this as you sort of go through chronologically. But Chuck Jones has always been sort of one of my heroes, and one of the things he said about those series of you got those cartoons. There's three of them with Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, and Elmer. You know, rabbit season, duck season, those things. He says, believe it or not, he put this much thought into it. He says, Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, and Elmer Fudd represent the id, the ego, and the superego.
Yep.
Like, it's actually wow. That. He's actually put that much thought into it. And because of that, I think they're kind of enduring, you know, symbols. They're kind of, you know what I mean? Like, they represent parts of the human psyche, and it's like, whoa, nice.
Basically, those three cartoons, Rabbit Fire, Rabbit Seasoning, and Duck, Rabbit, Duck, those are basically... the Star Wars trilogy for Looney Tunes.
Yeah, that's probably true. I mean, there's a lot of the same... Basically, they're interchangeable.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the same setup and then just a lot of different gags. But those are a lot of the, you know... Chuck Jones basically made all of the cartoons that everyone remembers. I mean, those and the What's Opera Doc and, like, Duck Amuck.
Yeah.
And, you know, all the ones that when you think about Looney Tunes, when you remember... You know, from being a kid, you're probably thinking of a Chuck Jones cartoon because he made sort of the most enduring ones, I think.
Oh, I completely agree. What about you, Matt? What are your general memories of just Looney Tunes in general?
Well, my thing was it was always the old Bugs Bunny and Tweety show collection. Like, they would play that after, like, about 10 on Saturdays, you know. And they'd play a bunch of Roadrunner cartoons, sort of the classic Bugs Bunny getting chased by Elmer Fudd stuff. All that kind of thing. That's sort of what really stuck with me back when I was a kid.
Yep. Yeah, going to what you said, Al, about the Chuck Jones thing, you know, he said that, you know, Bugs Bunny will always be able to outsmart Daffy Duck and Elmer Fudd. You know, but I mean, in those three cartoons, Elmer is basically portrayed as the dumb hunter. And,
right.
And, you know, Bugs is the one that knows how to get hit, like, you know, dressing up in a dress or dressing up as... as the femme of the cartoon, and Daffy tries, but Daffy loses, and his bill will end up either upside down on I think it's very weird if you pause any one of those cartoons where Elmer shoots Daffy and Bill falls off. It's very weird seeing a billless Daffy Duck.
Yeah, it really is. He's just got that sort of black head with the eyes and nothing else. I think it's interesting, again, Chuck Jones, and I'm probably going to be saying that name a lot because, the man was a genius. But he sort of, again, defined those characters in that way. He made Daffy the sort of petty, greedy kind of, you know, like before him, Daffy just kind of jumped up and down and went woo-hoo, woo-hoo, which is funny. But, you know, he kind of gave him a little bit of depth and something to play off of for the other characters. And he made, instead of Bugs just kind of jumping around, he made him sort of the underdog, sort of like, of course you realize this means war. I mean, he always started out in a very innocent position, then his turf was kind of invaded, and then he fought back. That was very much a Chuck Jones conceit that Bugs was sort of, and it was kind of that wartime American, you know, we're going to stay over here out of the way, but if you fuck with us, then we're going to come after you. And that was, Bugs Bunny very much, I think, embodied that whole spirit.
Oh, I completely agree. And before we go into the characters, I actually have Bugs Bunny saying this.
Of course, you know, this means war.
Yes, right. So going into the characters, I actually, you know, going... It was very... Even though I've spent the... Because I started doing research on this last Monday. I started watching the Golden Collection DVD sets, which we will be talking about later on. But doing the research for these cartoons is extremely hard, because it's not found under one banner. Like if you look up Transformers, you can get a majority of, you know, the show premise, the production, the cast, stuff like that. This I searched six different things.
Looking back at the shows that you've covered on your podcast, you seem to tend to cover episodic shows that aired on TV, whereas, of course, I'm sure you know, these started as theatrical shorts. There is no continuity, there is no, like, there's nothing to unite these other than the fact that they were made by the same studio for, you know, 30 years or whatever, and so pulling them all into one place for DVD release or for even for archiving purposes seems obvious to us now, but back then, it was almost disposable. You'd make it, you put it in front of a movie, then you do the next one. And, you know, it's just 7 minutes of cartoon, no big deal, you know. And now that we have this culture that kind of wants to preserve everything, it is a bit of a nightmare, I imagine, for someone in your position to have to go back and count it all, you know.
Yeah, I mean, this has probably been the most difficult research I've done for this show.
Well, I can't imagine any other show you've done that had over 1,000 episodes.
True. I mean, I'm not complaining about doing the research. I mean, I do it...
Oh, no, doing research watching cartoons is hardly, you know, like...
Yeah, I mean, I'm not complaining about that at all. I'm just saying that just finding the actual information to go along with this episode as we go was difficult. I'm just going to pick out some of the highlighted characters from each of the decades. In the 30s, the first introduced were the black and white Looney Tunes characters, Bosco.
We've discussed Bosco and Honey a bit. Honey would be his girlfriend, I believe. We've discussed them a bit on our own podcast. We're sort of fascinated with that early black and white, bouncing up and down on their knees, playing the ukulele with the weird flowers and the... Yeah.
Bosco was Mickey Mouse with a full set of teeth. is what
a unique and wonderful distinction.
Yes, very much so. And then, of course, you had Porky, Pig, Daffy Duck, and actually, it's funny, Granny was introduced in the 1930s. I did not know that. And those...
Granny voiced by the great June Foray.
She was voiced by somebody else first, I think, and then June took over. I'm not sure, though. I can't be for certain on that. You know... And of course, you know, we can spend a little bit of time talking about Porky Pig and Daffy. Porky, I think my favorite Porky cartoon is You Ought to Be in Pictures.
That's an early one, isn't it? That's one of those go out to the studio and you got all the like the Hollywood caricatures. Am I remembering that one?
Yeah, it's basically it's Porky and Daffy. Daffy convinces Porky to quit animation. He goes into the actual
Oh, right, right. There's some real life, like there's some Roger Rabbit stuff going on there.
Yeah. He actually goes into the real life Leon Schlesinger office, actually talks to the real Leon, says he wants to rip his contract up, and he drives to a Hollywood studio where you actually see Mike Maltese, who was one of the writers. He was mainly Chuck Jones's writer.
Yeah, one of the best.
Oh, yeah, writers. Very much so. You actually see Mike Maltese, but it's not his voice. It's Mel Blanc doing a voice.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and it's like, so you want me to let you in there? And Forky's like, he's nodding his head. He's like, yeah, yeah. So I can lose my job. And Forky starts nodding, yeah, and he's like, no. And then Mike, the live-action Mike Maltese, picks up Porky's animated car and just, like, tosses him out. So the whole cartoon is basically Porky trying to get into live pictures. And then at the end, he comes back to the Schlesinger Studios and says, Leon, can I have my job back? Oh, yeah, Porky, I knew you weren't. And he hadn't actually, because Porky asks him to tear up his contract. He tore a fake one, and he still had the real one. And of course, as we all know, Daffy is always out for himself. And that's why he told Porky to go to live, real movie pictures, so he can get his own animation slot. And at the end of the picture, you don't see this. It's off screen, but Porky basically goes in there and beats the hell out of Daffy. One of my favorite bits with Daffy is one of his very earlier cartoons. I have a clip of it. It was a bunch of cartoons put into one. It's called The Corny Concerto. It's Elmer Fudd as we know him, but he's in like this, like opera, like.
Oh, if I'm not mistaken, that's meant to be like a Fantasia parody, right?
So,
like with the conductor talking to the audience.
Yeah, exactly. But throughout the entire thing of Elmer introducing each cartoon, his tux flap will flap up, or his pants will fall down.
Right, and it does that like window shade like thing.
But here's my favorite part about the it was part of the Blue Danube.
Wasn't that lovely? And now we will present.
It's basically, it's a mother swan and her three baby swans, going the quack quack, and then Daffy comes up behind them and out of character does the wah wah. It's like.
Well, one of the things I think they did really well was incorporate the music. The music, the scores, like I own the Carl Stalling, they put out two best of collections of his score, and it's fantastic stuff. But what you have in that clip is the music sort of driving the action, and those quack quacks. It sounds great here on the podcast, and it just brings this picture to your head of you know exactly what's going on. They were really good at melding the music and the animation together.
Very, very much so. And in the 40s, you had, of course, Bugs Bunny was introduced, Iggy Buzzard, the Barnyard Dog, Foghorn Leghorn, the Goofy Gophers. Oh my.
we've discussed them a bit on our show as well.
Is that actually the name for them? I did not know that.
Yeah, we couldn't. There was much debate, and I don't remember if this ended up on our podcast or not, over whether they were gophers or woodchucks or what, and if they were in fact homosexual. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I think they probably.
Well, the funny thing about them is the reason why you would probably think that is because they are so friggin' polite to each other.
Well, that and they're very femmy. They're very, oh no, after you. Oh no, I insist. It's very. It reminds me of like Frasier and his brother, like that. If they're not gay, at least they've never like gone outside or Now I'm just describing us. Never mind.
Wow. Oh, and I should let you guys know we are explicit. So if you feel the need to curse, please go ahead.
Oh, thanks.
I should have told you before we started recording. So, yeah,
I actually meant to ask you before I let the first F-bomb fly and like, oh,
yeah.
Is he going to have to delete that? Hey,
I do not make podcasts for children.
Yeah. Just you talk about cartoons, isn't it?
Technically, these were not made for kids. These
No, absolutely not.
All of the directors and animators and everybody else said that these we made them for us. We didn't make them for kids.
Well, they put them in front of adult movies. Like porn, but like, you know, like movies like Casablanca or something. I mean, not.
I can just see Al sitting over there going, quote unquote, adult movies.
Well, as soon as it came out of my mouth, I'm like, adult movies? No, not like those kind of adults.
Not adult, no.
You know, like grown up movies. Like I say, like something like Casablanca or something like, you know, Citizen Kane or, you know, like. Real movies, not it wasn't a go see The Wizard of Oz and also see a cartoon. They were, you know, they were in front of serious movies.
Let's see, Cecil Turtle, who was that? I love those cartoons. The Tortoise Beats Hare and all.
Yeah, they did a few.
Those are great. Elmer Fudd, Henry Hawk, Martian. Actually, it's funny. I was watching one of the things on Marvin, and when they first created that character, he didn't actually have a name. And then Chuck said something about he was going to use his middle name, which is Martin. And then he said, oh, well, I find the name Marvin very funny, so I just call him Marvin the Martian. Pepe Le Pew, Penelope Pussycat. Ooh, that's...
I believe that's the Pepe Le Pew's female cat victim.
Roadrunner. Rocky and Muggsy. Actually, it's funny. I have a clip from Rocky telling Bugs to shut up. Actually, he's talking to Bugs.
Shut up, shutting up.
I always that was really, really funny. Sylvester, Tweety, the Three Bears. I don't remember Wacky Worm. Whatever. Wile E. Coyote and Yosemite Sam. Yosemite Sam was basically Friz Freleng animated.
Yeah, that was those guys. There was a lot of that, apparently. A lot of making fun of each other. A lot of I do remember, and I don't know if you have this in any of your notes, and I don't want to certainly steal your thunder, but the very famous. I believe the first Bugs Bunny cartoon to win an Oscar was it was the bullfighting one. I think it was Bully for Bugs, if I'm not mistaken. They were told in no uncertain terms, totally out of the blue. They were not prompted on this. One of the Warner Brothers or Friz Freleng or somebody came in and said, don't make a cartoon about bullfighting. Bullfighting's not funny. And they all looked at each other and I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Now we have
it's funny you mention that because I was just watching it before we I was just watching the special feature about that before we recorded this. Ooh, it was Ed something. It was the guy that took over after Leon sold out.
But the fact that they made their first Oscar-winning cartoon to spite their boss is just that pretty much sums those guys up to me.
Yeah, that's a philosophy.
Exactly. A lot of these characters in the '40s are the main ones that we know. A good majority.
The '40s is like kind of when they came into their own. I mean, the wartime period, and then after that is sort of what the golden age of the.
Yes,
of
and the we should mention that Egghead actually Egghead became Elmer. In the '50s thing on my information here, it says Egghead Jr. I don't ever remember seeing Egghead Jr.
I think he was in like one or two cartoons. Egghead was he had a sort of an eggish head. He had a big bulbous red nose and. Walked around. He had one of those dumb guy voices, one of those kind of voices. And, he was a hunter, and you can kind of see the evolution to Elmer, but he wasn't quite there yet. And I think they had one or two where he brought sort of a smaller version of himself along.
Yeah, and then, of course, we need to mention along with... we're going to get into the voice actors. I need to say this. Voice actor segment, not actors.
No, in this case, you have Mel Blanc, you have the occasional guest star. And
Elmer was actually done by somebody else. It was done by... And so,
Arthur Q. Bryant, right?
In the '50s, like I was saying, I don't recognize a lot of these. I recognize Sam the Sheepdog and Ralph the Wolf, which those are always really funny, because I always seem to think it's the coyote. I don't...
He just had... it's the same... It's
really
the same model.
Similar design,
they just give him a red nose, basically.
Yeah.
Yep.
Morning, Sam.
We have Speedy Gonzalez and Slowpoke Rodriguez. They said that they said the Speedy Gonzales cartoons were really easy to animate because it was like really really going fast, but it took like I don't know like 12 minutes per frame to do the slowpoke thing because he talks like this all the time.
Right.
Let me see if I can get my voice into motion here. I used to be able to talk like Marvin the Martian and give me my Iridium PU-36 space modulator. I used to be. There you go. I used to be able to do it. I did it when I was younger. I'm getting too old now, Christ.
Where's the kaboom? There was supposed to be a crash after in kaboom.
Okay, which one of you did that? Oh, that's almost just like it.
I was a very lonely child.
Wow. Oh, wow.
You'll be my friend, won't you, Marvin?
Of course I will.
Oh, wow. I also have to put the... I don't actually know how much audio I'm going to put in between this episode because there's so much to go by, but Michigan J. Frog came out in the 50s.
One froggy human. That is, I think, the single greatest Looney Tunes to make, in my personal opinion. Not a single line of dialogue in it, and it's so fantastic.
I just love watching this guy completely go insane by the end of the episode. You know,
and
I love how realistic all the surroundings are, and the frog is the only cartoony element of it. Everything else is like horrible and worn down and you know miserable. And then there's this one just ridiculous animated frog, and
it's almost got like a Twilight Zone feel to it. You know,
very very much so. It's actually funny. I'm not sure if it's at the beginning or the end of that cartoon. If you look at where the frog comes from out of the building, it says the Treg Brown building or something like that. Treg Brown was the amazing sound effects guy or sound design guy for Warner Brothers back then. Also in the 50s, you had Sylvester Jr., who was done by Snell, and Tasmanian Devil.
Yeah.
Oh, I should mention, Witch Hazel. Was it Broomstick? Broomstick Bunny when Bugs dresses up for Halloween as a witch, and at the very end of it, throughout that whole cartoon, she's like, I'm so deathly afraid of getting pretty. At the very end, she goes, Matt, she turns into this, like, hot redhead or something. Oh, Magic Mirror, who is the ugliest one of all? He's like, rawr, 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 and he runs off on a magic broomstick. And then I'm not sure if I really want to bring up the whole 1960s and beyond because half the stuff that are listed in here is people from Animaniacs, Tiny Toons, and we've already covered those on Tooncast. Everybody knows those characters. I'm actually surprised that they list Freakazoid in with this bunch. I don't associate Freakazoid with Looney Tunes.
Well, I mean, I expect that must be a sort of an overall list of Warner Brothers animation characters. They sort of shut their doors in the 60s, and when they started making Tiny Toons and then Animaniacs and all that, that was sort of, starting the factory back up. And so I imagine it's in Warner Brothers' best interest to say, look, it's all part of one big legacy, but really it's not.
I mean, that character was obviously influenced by, like, that kind of type of cartoon, too. So, I mean, that might
be exactly. So going into the voice actor segment here. You have Melvin Jerome, quote-unquote Mel Blanc, born May 30th, 1908, died July 10th, 1989. Was American.
And I have to say, I don't know how old you are, Mike, but when he died, that was actually, like, I remember that day, believe it or not. That was pretty sad.
Wow.
Yeah, I was, I guess I would have been like 14, and I cried. I mean, I won't lie to you. There was this really touching print ad that they put out and you guys may have seen this, all of the Looney Tunes characters gather around a microphone with a spotlight, which was empty, in front of a microphone, and they all have their heads down, and the caption just says, speechless. And that just, every time I see it...
We will be talking about his death a little bit later on. It's all about sharing memories and, whatever else, that's fine, but I'm just saying, as far as...
Yeah, chronologically, I'm jumping to his bath and you're talking about this.
All right. He was an American voice actor and comedian, although he began a six-decade-long career performing in radio commercials. Blank is best remembered for his work with Warner Brothers during the so-called, quote-unquote, golden age of American animation, and later for Hanna-Barbera television productions. As the voice of such well-known characters as Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, Porky Pig, Sylvester the Cat, Mickey Buzzard, Tweety Bird, Foghorn Leghorn, Yosemite Sam, Wile E. Coyote, which technically, I don't know how he could get a voice credit for Wile E. Coyote. I mean, he did talk.
He talked a couple of times.
Super genius. Wile E. Coyote, genius.
wow. Barney Rubble, Mr. Spacely, and hundreds of others.
Yep.
Having earned the nickname the Man of a Thousand Voices, Blank is regarded as one of the most influential persons in his field. You know, as I said, he's had he has got one of the longest his resume could almost outrank Frank Welker, which is very hard to do considering Frank does everything.
Well, I think Frank Welker at least has the distinction of doing a lot of like incidental sound effects and you know, things like that for movies, like when they need animal sounds, when they need, you know, just ambient sound, they get him, whereas Mel Blanc was, I believe, a straight up voice guy. So
just overall, I mean, just looking at this information as far as I didn't actually know that Barney Rubble was him. I knew Mel as the Looney Tunes characters. I didn't know anything past the Looney Tunes stuff.
Basically all that Hanna-Barbera stuff from the Flintstones on through the 60s and 70s, he was in there somewhere. He never stopped working until he passed. It was unbelievable.
Very,
the guy was
very
amazing.
Much so. And it's very funny how he actually trained his son Noel Blanc to do the voices, and I have a voice clip of that. I'll play it now. And when I saw that on the DVD set, I'm like, oh my god, it's just like mirror image. You know, the car accident thing, on January 24th, 1961, Blank was involved in a near-fatal car accident on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood. Hit head-on, Blank suffered triple skull fracture that left him in a coma for 3 weeks, along with fractures of both legs and the pelvis. The accident prompted over 15,000 get-well cards from anxious fans, including some addressed only to Bugs Bunny, Hollywood USA. Well, you know, a lot of voice actors and stuff back then, you didn't know how to... I mean, you know, us kids, you know, we don't know how... You know, it's just like sending a letter to Santa Claus.
Well, and that's one of my favorite stories about... And I know you're talking about Mel Blanc right now, but this has to do with Chuck Jones again. He said one time a kid walked up to him and his mother said, this is Chuck Jones. He draws Bugs Bunny. And the kid says, no, he doesn't. He draws pictures of Bugs Bunny. Because to this kid, there is a real Bugs Bunny in the world, and Chuck Jones is just copying down what he looks like. Bugs Bunny is a real, you know, being. And Chuck Jones didn't create him. He's drawing.
Somehow that always reminds, you know, when people say, you know, you didn't create him, you're just drawing him. Somehow I always go back to Chasing Amy. You fucking tracer.
Well, now you're getting into a whole other territory there.
And here is the accident clip.
Noel told me that almost every bone in his body was broken.
He was unconscious for a long time. Finally, a doctor got an idea because my dad had a television in his room, and it was playing Bugs Bunny cartoons. So the doctor went over to the bed and clapped his hands and said, Bugs, can you hear me? Bugs, can you hear me? My dad goes, what's up, Doc? The first words that he uttered were of Bugs and saying, what's up, Doc? Then he says, Porky, can you hear me? And he would answer me, I can hear you. Dad. So he brought him around doing the characters' voices before my dad was fully awake as himself.
So, you know, I don't know who that doctor was, but he's a certifiable genius.
Yeah.
It's just so awesome. You know, and then of course, as we mentioned before, he also did voice work for Hanna-Barbera, which, you know, he did some ensemble cartoon stuff like Wacky Races, Perils of Penelope Pitstop. It's actually funny. He, you know, Warner Brothers, they were not going to give him a salary increase. So he then said, "Okay, well, I want sole credit for the voice for the voice characterizations." And a majority, a good 95% of Looney Tunes cartoons say nothing but voice characterization, Mel Blanc. There are only a few that say other people.
Yeah, there's a couple I can think of. One of my favorites, I believe, was a Fritz Feeling cartoon, was the Three Little Bops, which is the story of the three little pigs as sort of jazz musicians. And that one was narrated. I'm not even sure.
Yeah, Stan Freberg did pretty much all of the voices in that.
Yeah, and that was a great one. But yeah, for the most part, Mel Blanc, and occasionally if you had a female voice, you'd get the great June Foray.
Chazel,
pretty much it.
Yeah,
well, she was with Chazel. I believe she was Granny. She went on to be Rocky on Rocky and Bullwinkle and Natasha. Mm. And
right,
and
she was exactly.
She was sort of the female.
Blanc also worked with Chuck Jones, who by this time was directing shorts of his own company, Sib Tower 12, later MGM Animation, doing vocal effects in the Tom and Jerry series from 1962 to 1967. Now, Tom and Jerry will be covered on Tooncast in a later episode. I do have the Tom and Jerry Chuck Jones collection on DVD, the two-disc DVD, so I laugh so hard at
that. Yeah, those are pretty great, too, actually.
So, Blanc reprised some of his Warner Brothers characters when the studio contracted to make new theatrical cartoons in the mid to late 1960s. For these, Blanc voiced Daffy Duck and Speedy Gonzales, the characters who received the most frequent use in the shorts. Later, newly introduced characters such as Cool Cat and Merlin the Magic Mouse were voiced by Larry Storch. Blanc also continued to voice Looney Tunes characters on the bridging sequences for the Bugs Bunny show in numerous animated advertisements. You know, and then of course we get into his death, and it's just like, what? It's kind of, and I'm not trying to compare it, but it's kind of like when he died, it's like, oh my God, where are we going to go from here with the Looney Tunes?
Well, it was kind of an end of the end of an era, really. I mean, you know, they had stopped making the theatrical shorts, but they were doing these sort of compilation movies. There was like the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner movie and a few others that would take those existing shorts and stitch them together with new animation that kind of wrapped it all together in one big story, and they would get Mel Blanc back for kind of continuity. And they've had other guys since then doing the voices. Billy West of Futurama has done them, lots of other people. And they're just, I mean, they're good, but they're not Mel Blanc. And it's kind of telling that when they do a movie like Space Jam or something like that, it takes four or five people to add.
But I mean, I don't think Space Jam was as bad. Right. No, but
I wasn't saying one way or the other.
Right.
I wasn't trying to reflect the quality of Space Jam. I'm just saying when you're casting a movie with Looney Tunes characters in it, you don't get one guy to do all the voices anymore because you're just not going to find a Mel Blanc. You got to find one person to be Sylvester and maybe Daffy Duck because they sound kind of the same. One person to be Bugs. There just isn't that.
Oh,
that
exactly.
Powerhouse of a
well,
guy
you know,
who can do all
Daffy
the voices.
And Sylvester. I mean, it's the same. With Mel, it was the same voice. All his Daffy is Sylvester sped up. Yeah. The only thing I'm going to really mention about his death was I found this very, very interesting. Blanc died on July 10th, 1989 at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, California of heart disease and emphysema. He was interred in the Hollywood Forever Cemetery in Hollywood, California. Blanc's will stated his desire to have the inscription on his gravestone read, "That's all, folks." And there, I don't know if you guys have the, the file pulled up, but there is a picture with this, and it does say that, and I think that's awesome. I mean, that's just a great callback to all his main work. And then, of course, you know, his children. Yeah. Blanc trained his son Noel in the field of voice characterization, while the younger Blanc has performed his father's characters, particularly Porky Pig, on some programs. He has chosen not to become a full-time voice artist. I kind of respect that for the guy. He's not trying to take over where his father left off. Yeah, exactly.
Again, you're never going to fill those shoes.
And of course, I have the list of all the characters, which I've already named for the majority of them. I'm just going to scroll down past those. You know, blanks and voiceover effects were used in many animated films, such as Paramount's Gulliver's Travels, as an uncredited voice over as King Bombo's Shout of Joy, to animated shorts from The Pink Panther, to most recently in Jetix's Pooka. You know, just a great, great voice artist. One of the best of all time, if not the best of all time, from that era. It's just not enough.
Well, yeah, I mean, without looking at your cheat sheet there, can you name another voice actor from that era? Really? I mean, from the 30s through the 60s. I mean, I can't. No names are coming to mind, and I kind of know this stuff.
Yeah,
he is. You know,
So I guess we're going to move on to the behind-the-scenes segment. There were, I believe, 5 or 6. I think the only one I left out in the research was Robert McKimson, only because I kind of forgot about his cartoons. Not really. I mean, I didn't really I didn't associate it with it.
If I'm not mistaken, Bob McKimson seemed to favor Yosemite Sam. There was a lot of chase cartoons, a lot of shouting.
Frizz Freleng. You had, like I said, Bob McKimson, Bob Clampett. Wow, I almost went brain dead there. Bob Clampett, Chuck Jones, and who was the other one? Oh, this is funny. Frederick Bean, Tex Avery. Bean Avery is his real name.
Yeah.
Tex sounds a heck of a lot better.
Yeah, I think we understand why he went with Tex there. And of course, Tex Avery's style very, very famous for the wolves on Hollywood and Vine, and the eyes popping out, and like the movie The Mask was basically a love letter to Tex Avery cartoon.
So, Chuck Jones, which, a majority of the Looney Tunes cartoons that are favorites of myself and probably everyone that likes them, the majority of them are Chuck Jones's material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And again, if you name any of the greats, the favorites, the ones you remember as a kid, chances are it's a Chuck Jones cartoon. I mean, like I say, What's Opera Doc and the Duck Rabbit Duck and One Froggy Evening and Duck Dodgers, and they're all him.
Yeah, very, very much so. And, he had, I think one of the best careers as far as I believe he started out as an animator, and then he went into the directing.
It's funny watching his really early stuff, because it's very conventional, almost kind of cutesy. He did, I think, like Sniffles the Mouse, and just very not interesting sort of Disney knockoff. And then once you see him really take off and get his own style, it's just amazing. And toward the end of his time at Warner's, I know he was he actually would time like a Roadrunner cartoon. He would time his gags down to the frame, like it's 24 frames a second. He would figure out, okay, the coyote falling for 7 frames is funny, but 8 frames is funnier. Like, 1/24th of a second made all the difference to his comedy. That's how much timing, that he invested in those is just amazing.
I mean, it's just awesome what this guy has done. I mean, I can, I can look over here to my the DVDs that I have set out, and I can probably count off almost every single cartoon that he's done that I like. I think one of my favorites was French Rarebit, where Bugs Bunny is in France, and these two chefs are fighting over who's going to cook him first, and at the end he ends up tricking them into turning them into rabbits and basically making them explode inside the oven.
You just don't see that in cartoons anymore.
I dare say Looney Tunes were the animated versions of the Three Stooges slapstick type of comedy. That's just the way...
Sure. Well, and there was some other sort of the classic vaudeville types. I mean, there's a lot of Marx Brothers in there. That phrase of Bugs that you played earlier, of course, this means war. That actually was originally Groucho Marx. And there's a lot of that in there. There's some Laurel and Hardy in there. There's some Buster Keaton. I mean, they
borrowed pretty much. Oh, yeah. And I don't think that they're ashamed about doing it either.
Yeah. Oh, no. I mean, that's, you know, people steal jokes in comedy. And if you're Will Wheaton, you steal jokes from me and you don't get credit.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I found that out in episode two when I was listening to earlier. So, yeah.
I don't mean to derail your thing there. I'm sorry. I just
on this show, there's so many things that, I mean, I almost made a George Bush Senior Junior reference earlier. I stopped myself, but I almost did.
Well, and it's interesting because that's one thing that Looney Tunes, like, they did deal with more, like, mature stuff, but they never really got into a lot of politics. They never really, you know, they managed to kind of keep it timeless and not, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, FDR Truman humor in there, which is great because we
exactly.
Do watch the house.
Going into the writers, I'm just going to mention these guys because there's so much biographical information on all of these people. The ones I remember the most, obviously Michael Maltese, who...
Yeah, he kind of wrote the gags for all those great Chuck Jones cartoons we were naming off earlier. And he loved his wordplay. There's stuff like Daffy, Jack and the Beanstalk. I don't remember what the title was offhand, but it was a Jack and the Beanstalk cartoon with Daffy and Bugs going up the Beanstalk and Elmer's the giant. And Michael Maltese loved his wordplay. It was like Daffy's running off and he's like, I can't wait to get those doubloons and triploons and quadruploons. And just lots of, you know, goofy little puns that there's no way little kids will get. Adults.
You have Ted Pierce, and then the one didn't list on here is actually Warren Foster. I believe Warren Foster wrote a majority of the Robert McKimson cartoons. Actually, it's funny about the McKimson cartoons. I noticed something, and I know that they mention it somewhere in the on one of the DVD special features on one of the sets. I don't remember where. I always look at the credits, because they're right there before the cartoon starts. Every Robert McKimson cartoon, majority of them, have his brother listed as an animated, Charles McKimson, as animator.
That's one way to keep the family employed, I guess.
You know, one of the cartoons that isn't, I don't think is actually on any of these sets, is one of my most favorites. I forget if it was, I'm not sure if it was Chuck that did it or not. It was the one with the two mice, Hubie and Birdie. They're house
like
hunting mice, where they
house?
Go into the house of, and they're it's basically Looney Tunes version of the MGM short House of Tomorrow, where they go into this futuristic house and it has all these. And this sweeper keeps coming out, and they keep trying to foil it. They tack down the record player so it doesn't come up, and they speed up the record thrower so it's throwing records all over the place. And by the end of the cartoon, Birdie, who is the dumber one of the two, presses the spring cleaning button, and all these other sweeper bots come out, and it sends them running. I often thought, and I don't know, maybe you can clarify, I could have sworn that was those two characters are a reference to, Abbott and Costello.
They could very well be. They did that a lot. There was, I remember one that was, I think it was called the Honey Mousers, where it was like the Honeymooners in mouse form, and there was one based on Jack Benny another time. There was a lot of that, so I
know they
that
did do a direct.
They definitely did a lot of that.
Abbott and Costello cartoon thing with Babbitt and Cat Stello. You know, I do remember that. The Jack Benny one you mentioned was the Owl Jolson one, where the parents are like, "You're going to be an opera singer," but the kid can't sing in opera, but he can sing in jazz.
Yeah, that's they referenced that in the very first episode of South Park, actually, where Cartman had the anal probe and zaps him, and he goes, "I want to sing about the moon in June and spring."
Yep.
That was a reference to that.
Yep.
That's where that's from.
Yeah.
I'm trying to resist saying this, but Matt, now you know, and knowing is half the battle. I tried to resist, but I couldn't.
The other half is killing.
Oh,
but
boy. So I think we're done with the behind-the-scenes segment. We're going to go into the actual show now. In the beginning, both as far as the history for the for the theatrical shorts, both Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies drew their storylines from Warner's vast music library. Also, from 1934 to 43, Merry Melodies were produced in color and Looney Tunes in black and white. Which, I mean, I knew that there were black and white Looney Tunes cartoons, but I didn't know that they were, one was color at one point, and then one was...
Yeah, I know there was definitely a distinction between the two series. And also, if I'm not mistaken, the name cartoon, and you may have more information on this, comes, like, the tune comes from the fact that they used these as sort of, like, primitive music videos when they first came out, and Disney kind of started it with the Silly Symphonies, but, like, Warner, like you say, with their vast library of pop songs, if you watch those early ones from, like, the late 30s, early 40s, they would always work a song in, and it's weird to think now that that's basically like the 40s version of MTV. They were trying to make their songs popular.
I completely agree. Both series also made use of the various Warner Brothers cartoon characters. By 1937, the theme music for Looney Tunes was The Merry-Go-Round Broke Down by Cliff Friend and Dave Franklin. The theme music for Merry Melodies was an adaptation of Merrily We Roll Along by Charles Tobias, Murray Mencher, and Eddie Cantor. Oh, I really butcher names sometimes. I didn't know those, but sometimes I will. What interests me really more than the actual some of the history on here, as far as like it changing, like throughout its course, there have been three or four different like Looney Tunes opening and closing gags. Like from 1937 to 1946, every Looney Tune except for two ended Porky Pig.
Two.
Ended with Porky Pig coming out of a drum saying, "That's all, folks." And then, of course, it changed. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's a rights change or studio change, but like the logo changed. Like there's a picture on here, Looney Tunes opening WB graphic from 1964. It's completely different from the one that we know. It's just a pink W and a B meshed together and says presents on a black background. Some of the more interesting bits, I think, are down here closer. Although cartoons are seldom seen on mainstream TV thanks to rival theatrical screening, the Golden Collection DVD box sets, Looney Tunes and its characters have remained a part of Western animation heritage. On October 22, 2007, Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies cartoons became available for the first time in high definition via Microsoft Xbox Live service, including some in Spanish.
Oh, nice. I didn't know that.
If you want to hear You're Despicable in Spanish, I guess you could do that. Which I don't know what the translation of that would be, and I don't want to know, I don't think. From February 29th to May 18th, 2008, many Looney Tunes artifacts, including original animation cells and concept drawings, were on display at the Butler Institute of American Art in Youngstown, Ohio, just off the campus of Youngstown State University. The exhibit had the studio come full circle as Warners were natives of the Youngstown area. Huh. I didn't know that either. Looney Tunes can currently be seen, which as we know is wrong, currently be seen on Kids WB website. Looney Tunes returned to Cartoon Network on January 1st, 2009 as a marathon called the New Year's Day Looney Tuner.
I remember when I first got Satellite Dish and I discovered that Cartoon Network in June would, like, I believe it was like the first weekend of June, would do this marathon called June Bugs, where it was just Bugs Bunny cartoons for like 48 hours. And I would just, whatever I was doing, I would just like cancel it, draw the shades, get a big pizza, and just sit there and watch Bugs Bunny cartoons all weekend. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
It's nice to see that they've gotten those back.
Oh, we need to come to work. No, I'm watching Bugs Bunny. All right, as long as you have a legitimate excuse.
No, it's nice because I think Cartoon Network knows, like, they appreciate the legacy of a lot of the old stuff, and they usually treat that stuff with respect. And I think if they do have those again, that's good because they'll show them, they'll display them, they'll keep them in circulation. They won't just put them on at midnight or something. You know?
Well, I kind of agree and I kind of disagree because Cartoon Network, as of February this year, has pretty much gone CN Real, and they're live action programming in with their own original cartoons. They have basically, Boomerang still runs like Tom and Jerry and stuff like that, but Looney Tunes after the New Year's Day marathon have not been seen on Cartoon Network or Boomerang since.
That's a damn shame. That's kind of like that MTV thing where they stopped showing videos. You know, I mean, why would you show live action on Cartoon Network? That's no good.
Yeah. Unless you've heard, there are other channels. You know,
that's true.
Yeah.
Put that on those.
Right.
Cartoon Network, you know, kind of obvious.
As far as the controversy, I'm not going to read all of it from the top, but there are stereotypes throughout a majority of some of these cartoons.
Sure, and a lot of that stuff was acceptable in the 30s and 40s, and that doesn't make it right, but, you know, it was back then. That's
a different time, yeah.
Yeah, that's what you did. I mean, our grandparents...
In addition to these most notorious cartoons, many Warner cartoons contain fleeting or sometimes extended gags that reference then-common racial or ethnic stereotypes. The release of the Looney Tunes Golden Collection Volume 3 includes a disclaimer at the beginning of each DVD in the volume given by Whoopi Goldberg, which explains that the cartoons are products of their time and contain racial and ethnic stereotypes that these days would be considered offensive, but the cartoons are going to be presented on the DVD uncut and uncensored because editing them out and therefore denying that stereotypes existed is almost as bad as condoning them.
So, since Whoopi Goldberg's black and she says it's okay, then it's okay.
Yeah. it's funny, I was right when... it's on Volume 4 and Volume 5. A written disclaimer similar to the words spoken by Goldberg in Volume 3 is shown at the beginning of each DVD in the Volume 4 and Volume 5 sets. Whoopi was too expensive for them to get back on air.
Well, you know, she's very busy doing...
Sister Act 4?
Whatever it is she's doing.
Sure. Some of the information here now, it's actually very interesting to me, the ownership. In the early 1950s, Warner Brothers sold its black and white Looney Tunes plus the first Merry Melody, Lady Play Your Mandolin, and the black and white Merry Melodies made after Harmon and Ising left to Sunset Productions. Warner insisted that the opening and closing titles be changed to remove all references to Warner Brothers. The cartoons were distributed by Guild Films until it was sold to Motion Pictures for Television. In the 1960s, Seven Arts Productions bought that company. In 1967, Seven Arts merged with Warner Brothers to create Warner Brothers-Seven Arts, thus putting those films back in Warner's ownership. So why the hell did they sell them in the first place? That makes no fucking sense whatsoever.
No, probably at the time it was... We watch companies merge and break up all the time. I mean, in the 90s, you know, there was AOL Time Warner, and I think now they're separate companies again, and looking back on that in 20 years, you'd be like, well, why did they merge if they just split apart? But,
at the time,
it probably makes sense.
I don't know. Let's see here. UA under pre-WB Warner, or pre-WB/Turner merger management of MGM/UA Home Video, officially released numerous compilations of the classic pre- 8-48 cartoons on VHS and Laserdisc. Most of these are under the title Golden Age of Looney Tunes. Today, Warner Home Video holds the video rights to the entire Looney Tunes/Merry Melodies animated output by virtue of WB's ownership of Turner Entertainment. This is why their Looney Tunes Golden Collection DVD box sets include cartoons from both the pre 8-48 Turner owned and post 7-48 WB owned periods.
And Turner, if I'm not mistaken, when he first got a hold of some of that stuff, was editing them. Do you have anything about that, where he would sort of take out the gunshots or take out the more objectionable stuff? It was kind of a big deal, like in the 80s. And I think that's been kind of swept under the carpet now. But for a while, there, TBS
not
was...
Really. I know I have a thing on here for quality of prints used for television and video. When the Looney Tunes were shown on TV, WB and AAP prepared 16mm dupes of the original prints for syndication market. These prints faded over time, causing them to look inferior to what was being shown on the network.
There was some of that as well, but there was Ted Turner, like, on TBS, and I think maybe TNT, would actually take out, like, you know, when you see Daffy's beak being shot off, they would actually, you would hear the gunshot sound, but they would cut away.
Yeah, I've heard about that. They cut to, like, just his beak hanging off or something.
Yeah, because kids, you know, they can't put together that a hunter has a gun and now Daffy doesn't have a beak.
I honestly, honestly, you know, like you guys, I believe you guys might have been saying it in your first episode of Sarcastic Voyage. I'm not sure. I know you had mentioned it, Al, that, you know, you haven't watched TV with commercials in a very, very long time.
Well, now DVR and TV and DVD.
Exactly. Well, that's what I'm saying. I honestly, I really don't care if Looney Tunes ever come back on TV, because people can just go out and buy the DVD.
See, to me, it's important because not everyone can go buy those DVDs, and because there will always be children the way we were children, you know, where you got your mom, you got your dad, and then you got your third parent, television. And it's, I think, you know, I don't want to get on a soapbox or anything, but I think it's important for Looney Tunes to be on as an alternative to whatever the crap is on right now.
Yeah, exactly. But,
And in that respect, I do hope that they are still on TV, because, you know,
having that option there, it's just like, well, you could watch crap or you could watch this.
Yeah, you could watch back when they actually drew each of 24 frames of animation instead of, you know, one frame per second.
I think the issue is obviously the editing and the racial stuff. I think that's what the real issue is, because those cartoons mentioned that were in that New Year's Day marathon on Cartoon Network, they were the edited versions.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So if you want unedited versions, you're going to have to go out and find the DVDs.
Right. Or you say now that they're restoring them for HD, I would imagine there'll be Blu-rays at some point.
Moving on to the music segment. The Merry-Go-Round Broke Down is a song written in 1937 by Cliff Friend and Dave Franklin. It is best known as the theme tune for Looney Tunes cartoon series produced by Warner Brothers Cartoons, used from 1937 to 1969. Which, you know, I think it's a very fitting theme for Looney Tunes. Because if you...
Oh, absolutely. And I remember that scene in Roger Rabbit where they use that as well, where he's in the bar singing... And then Judge Doom walks in and he says,
"Merry-go-round broke down."
Yeah, I hope people remember, you know, Roger Rabbit, because that was a fantastic sort of tribute to that golden age.
After he says it, he goes, "Kind of a loony selection for a bunch of drunken
reprobates." No, but when you talk Looney Tunes music, really, there's, again, kind of like Looney Tunes voices, there's really only one name, and that's Carl Stalling. The guy was a mad genius. He would take all these different pieces of music and stitch them together into this insane carnival music, you know, jamboree of stuff. And, I mean, now you hear, like, xylophone going doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, and you think, oh, well, someone's climbing up steps. But he's kind of the guy who invented that. I mean... He just came up with all these crazy, you know, ridiculous things. And again, I have the collections they put out of his, and they're just amazing. You just put them on and listen, and you close your eyes, and you can picture what's going on. This
I
guy
think
was
my
just
favorite
amazing.
Out of his music, because he basically put the music to the animation when it came to Looney Tunes. You know, like you said, you know, xylophone going upstairs or going downstairs. One of my favorite cartoons to watch for that type of deal is Duck Amuck.
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of pantomime. There's a lot of, like, you know, parts where the dialogue kind of goes and the music pretty much carries the action, and he carries it so well. And he would take pieces, like he would take musical quotes, like different little snippets of things, like and a lot of times they were puns, and if you didn't know the titles of the music, the joke would be lost on you. But like he would take there's a guy called Raymond Scott who wrote a lot of really bizarre music. He wrote the powerhouse, that music that everybody, you know, everybody knows that. Everybody knows, like, it's famous cartoon music. He would borrow that. He would borrow all this stuff. Whenever you'd see cannibals on the screen, he would take a Raymond Scott piece called Dinner Music for a Pack of Hungry Cannibals. And it's a joke that, like, three people would get. And Carl Stalling's just, like, cackling madly, composing the orchestra. Cannibals, get it?
Yes, there are, you know, like you said, there are two soundtracks. The Carl Stalling Project, music from Warner Brothers Cartoons, 1936 to 1958. And then Volume 2, more music from Warner Brothers Cartoons, 1939 to 1957.
and you really want to freak somebody out, you you put that at full blast at a traffic light. they get a lot of strange looks.
Wow. So going into the legacy segment, actually, it's become a running gag on this show to for the majority of our shows, you know, as you said before, they're episodic cartoons like Mask, Transformers, stuff like that. And normally IGN would have, normally in the reception, I would have a listing of wherever the show is ranked. Thank God IGN hasn't been able to get a hold of these things, because some of their top 100 animated shows, they ranked Mask 99th. Oh, God. Hey.
That's about right.
It had, you know, as far as Looney Tunes, four of the Looney Tunes have been selected to the National Film Registry. Those are What's Opera Doc, Duck Amuck, Porky and Wacky Land, and One Froggy Evening. It is one.
Notable that three of those four are done by Chuck Jones.
It has been nominated for tons of Academy Awards. It is one. For Best Short Subject Animation, Tweety Pie won for Sentimental Reasons, Speedy Gonzales, Birds Anonymous, and Nighty Night Bugs. For Sentimental Reasons is probably my favorite Pepe Le Pew cartoon.
Those are fairly interchangeable to me. I mean, they're all pretty good, but I don't think any one stands out more than any of the others. It's kind of like the... Yeah. The Roadrunner ones, where to me it's just a series of gags. I mean, was there anything specifically...
I think it's because of the fact that there is one scene where the cat ends up inside this, like, circus cage. Like, you know, you put the animal in behind and then you have a glass display on the outside. And Pepe's... It's almost like a husband and wife thing where Pepe's standing outside, let me in, let me in, and it's nothing but sound effects. Yeah.
Oh, right, yeah, that, there's a whole pantomime bed where... And she, like, holds her, you know, and you can tell she's saying, because you stink.
And but then at the end, of course, she ends up in the water, and the hair dye washes off. He ends up in the blue paint, and she ends up chasing after him.
Classic Twilight Zone ending there.
Yeah, exactly.
As far as the television broadcast history, there were, like, a whole bunch of countries... I really don't care. I'm just going to bring up the USA stuff.
And Canada. Don't
yes,
Canada.
I know. I wasn't forgetting. It actually wasn't here, listed. So in Canada... Okay. No, I'm serious. If you go to Wiki, I swear I'm not joking. It was not listed.
Okay.
Well, Canada has these weird Canadian content laws where a certain percentage of their broadcast material has to be of Canadian origin. So maybe there just wasn't enough Canadian animators in working for Warner Brothers.
And the only cartoon we got up here was Pierre the Happy Walrus. Did not go over well.
Yeah, maybe Tooncast number 850 will be about Pierre the Happy Walrus. But he's got bigger fish to fry for
100.
Now.
Forget episode 150. It aired on Boomerang, Cartoon Network, Nickelodeon, TNT, TBS. It was in syndication from 1955 to the present day.
1955?
November 5th, 1955. That day. Why do I remember that? Oh, yeah, that's when I made this, the flux capacitor.
There it is.
ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, and Kids WB.
Yeah, and at one point in there, they had the great special what do you call it, bumpers with the song that, like, they're all putting on a show, and you know, on with the show. This is it.
That was Bugs Bunny Tweety show.
I think that was ABC.
Firmly implanted in my memories from that.
This franchise has garnered a lot of video games too. There are tons of video games.
And I can't think of
only one that really sticks out in my head, only because I played it like crazy on the classic original Game Boy, was Bugs Bunny and Crazy Castle. It's basically Bugs Bunny going from room to room in a castle looking for carrots.
Yeah, they could basically just have put anything in there. I think they just needed a license. I think I remember hearing that was originally Mickey, that they changed it to Mickey Mouse when it went to Japan. Same game, different character.
Actually, the one that recently really wanted, actually I did have before I had to end up selling my PlayStation 2, but anyway, was Looney Tunes Acme Arsenal. Basically, it was basically Looney Tunes meets Halo. You basically give them all kinds of weird cartoon gaggy type of weapons, and you have to take them through, like, you can play as like three or four, like Bugs, Daffy, and like two or three other characters. I don't know, it was really, really cool. Outside of that, I don't really
I think if they got the cartoon physics, like if they really paid close attention to the way, like, an anvil falls on a seesaw or something, that might actually be kind of fun.
God, I played a ton of these when I was a kid. Was funny, really? Blowout. Oh shit, yeah.
I've never heard of any of these.
I was waiting for a Looney Tunes version of Jordan versus Bird.
A Space Jam ripoff.
Yeah, I guess
Bugs.
We should mention the two Looney Tunes inspired movies. Obviously, Space Jam, and then Looney Tunes Back in Action.
I gotta say, honestly, and I am totally on an island here, I liked Back in Action quite a lot. It was directed by Joe Dante, the great Joe Dante, who did the Gremlins movies and Inner Space and a lot of really good movies. It was not like, you know, it wasn't a classic golden age cartoon, but it was a lot of fun. I laughed quite a bit.
No, I mean,
and, it's a lot better than
I'm just going
before.
Off of what I've heard. Yeah.
No, I wasn't saying you're saying it's bad. I'm just saying, in general, to your listeners, you want to dismiss this movie as, oh, they made a Looney Tunes movie in the 2000s. This has to suck.
What I had heard from anyone who was talking about it.
No, and it wasn't a classic, but it was. I laughed a fair amount. It was a nice, like, Joe Dante, I think, has been trying to make a sort of Looney Tunes tribute for quite some time. Gremlins 2 was basically one big live-action Looney Tunes film.
Sure.
And he finally just got to make a Looney Tunes movie.
Yeah, I completely agree. While there are some actors in there that I really could care less about, but like Brendan Fraser, but I, you know...
The great Jenna Elfman.
Well, see, that's what I like, because it put a face on Acme. If you take all those Roadrunner cartoons, and, you know, or you take Bugs ordering something from somebody, I want that, though. Bugs orders something, and it's instant delivery. We need that. We need that today. We need instant delivery, not this, you know, $45 for UPS.
Well, hey, here in Seattle, we have Amazon Fresh, which basically can bring you anything Amazon has, or groceries within the same day. So we're nearly there. I don't know what's wrong with the restaurant.
Getting closer. Still, if you need a catapult in a hurry, you're still waiting at least a week these days.
I'm pretty sure Amazon has catapults. We've given up our search for crossbows, I think. We've moved on to bigger and better. Well, let's see. Catapult is a popular... Yes, there is, in fact, a catapult on Amazon.
Okay, now see if you can get a trebuchet.
How would you wield one of those things?
Nice word of you using the word wield. Yep, desktop trebuchet, $34.95.
Finally.
We're recording this at night now, unfortunately. If I ordered it tomorrow morning, I would have it by tomorrow night.
Yeah.
So we're nearly to the Acme...
But I mean, that, you know, Steve Martin, they basically, with that character, they put a face on the Acme Corporation.
Mm-hmm. See, and I would totally buy Steve Martin being charged of the Acme Corporation.
Sure. The biggest laugh in that film for me came toward the end when they're unmasking Steve Martin. And I'm going to spoil Looney Tunes Back in Action for people, so, you know, stop listening for a minute now if you're worried about spoilers. But, there's a bit where they're unmasking Steve Martin, you know, because, of course, he can't just be Steve Martin. He's got to be some, you know, evil
like notorious, whatever.
And they keep Christopher Lloyd.
They keep pulling off a mask, and he's somebody else, and he's somebody else, and he's somebody else, and they pull it off, and he's Michael Jordan. And Daffy looks at him, looks at the camera, and says, "This doesn't make a lick of sense." And then they keep going with the mask gag. And that was it. He didn't have a line. He didn't, like, because Michael Jordan's kind of a ham. He kind of, you know, and he was his unspoken cameo.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah, and just everything, the joke visually, the way he sold the line, you know, that doesn't make a lick of sense. And that's to this day. I saw that movie a few years ago. That's still in my lexicon. I still say, that doesn't make a lick
of
sense.
Always use Hubie and Birdie. I believe it's Birdie that goes, like Hubie will ask him, "Are you ready?" "Yeah, yeah, sure, sure, right." Always use that.
I do remember
for
that.
Its time, I thought Space Jam was really well done.
I'm just not a sports guy, so it was that whole thing was kind of lost on me.
Such a strange concept for a movie, you know? Like, we're going to make a Looney Tunes movie with Michael Jordan where they play basketball against aliens. I got to say, if I was told to predict what the new Looney Tunes movie was going to be about, it would not be that.
I think one of the most funniest, like, humiliating moments of that film is the scene where they've lost all their powers, and Charles Barkley tries to go play basketball with some girls, and he can't play because he's lost his powers, and they basically just shun him. So, getting to the DVDs here, we have the Looney Tunes Golden Collection, an annual series of 6 4-disc DVD box sets from Warner Brothers Home Video, and each containing about 60 Looney Tunes cartoons and Mary Melody's animated shorts. The series began in October 2003 and ended in October 2008. No, they're not.
They're not releasing any of those anymore.
There is a note down here. According to Jerry Beck, consulting producer to the Golden Collection series, Warner Home Video will continue to release Looney Tunes cartoons on DVD in 2009 and beyond, presumably as different series. However, the January 28, 2009 discussion on Shokas Internet Radio, Beck stated that there would be no such releases in 2009. So basically, he just contradicted himself. Actually, I am friends with Jerry Beck on Facebook. that's kind of sad, but whatever.
Oh, nice. I will say the thing, and you may not agree with me here, but I think it's kind of a marketing good idea marketing wise for them. They're not releasing these chronologically because really, if they started in 1930, whatever it was, with the Bosco and Honey and you know all that, who's going to buy that? So what they do is they throw in Duck Dodgers. And they throw in, you know, something like that in volume one. So you got to buy volume one. And then they throw in What's Opera Doc in volume two. So you got to buy volume two. And yeah, it's kind of crap that you got to buy them all. But on the other hand, you know, they're moving.
My
DVDs
only
that
complaint
way.
About
you, you know
the DVD sets is as they go along, they get smaller. And I don't mean in content. I mean as far as the packaging, like volumes 1 through 3. Are these big, you know, fold-out sets. Volumes 4 through 6 are just, you know, they fold out 3 ways, but it's basically 4 discs on top of each other. It's not 4 separate discs in each of their own thing. I just don't like that type of DVD packaging because it makes it harder for me to find the discs that I want at the same time, whereas you put it all up at once and it's each one and it's each own thing instead of on top of each other. Overall, I would recommend anybody that is a Looney Tunes fan to get these sets.
I can't imagine there's anyone out there that is a Looney Tunes fan that doesn't own these, but yes, absolutely.
Go ahead, Matt. What were you going to say?
Yeah.
No, I thought you were going to say something.
What? No, I... nothing.
Yeah, and...
I was agreeing with Al.
Yeah, excuse me. We must note that you must... If you are going to get a... I guess you could call it the full Looney Tunes type of collection DVD sets... Get the Golden Collection, not the Spotlight. The Spotlight is a trimmed down, less number of cartoons per set. I do want to get some of the movie collections, like, you know, Bugs Bunny Roadrunner movie, stuff like that. I know Daffy Duck's Quackbusters is out on DVD now. And I
Well, that's one of those, like I mentioned before, they do those... sort of compilations of old cartoons stitched together with new footage.
Which I did like that. I thought that was pretty cool. So we are going to move into the closing, and this is the point where we're going to give some final thoughts, and I will let you guys go first. Matt, why don't you go first on your final thoughts on Looney Tunes?
Oh, God.
Yes, the spotlight shining on you.
Yeah, sort of blanking now.
Matt always performs well under pressure. We've proved
oh, yeah.
our own show as well.
You know what, yep. maybe... Al, you got something? Please?
Looney Tunes, what's that? No, sorry, Matt, you're on your own. No, like I've said, I look up to these. I am very much a student of all forms of comedy. That is just my thing. And listening to our show, I'm sure people, anyone who's listened to us knows, I love to pick apart comedy and see how it works. And Chuck Jones, to me, is up way up there with the best, like, in any medium of comedy. He's up there in sort of my top five. I wish I could be this good. This man is a genius. And, yeah, the other Looney Tunes are good, and I won't deny that. But really, Chuck Jones, you know, Chuck Jones, Looney Tunes, anything from about 1945 to about 1955 is just some of the best animation.
Oh yeah, I completely agree with him and him and Mike Maltese. You know, they're the you know writer director team.
Yeah,
get for these cartoons.
Yeah,
no, it's actually funny. I noticed watching a lot of these different ones, like stuff from Friz Freleng and Tex Avery, Robert McKimson and Bob Clampett, and all that stuff. Some of the stuff that you basically have to catch it, but if you don't, you're like, oh, what was that? And you have to go back and look. It's kind of like one of those double take things. In a I forget which Sylvester and Tweety cartoon
right.
it is, there is Drink Friz Cola, and Friz is upside down, but it's meant to be Friz Freleng. And then in one of the McKimson cartoons, it's like the Robert McKimson... No, it's like the McKimson building. So they put all... the animators put all kinds of stuff
right.
in each of the directors.
Yeah, they put their own names in there, but they also put like clever jokes in there too. So it's always nice to look for the.
Do you guys have anything
that
you would like to plug? This is the time to plug stuff.
I think I sold our show at the top. So Matt, if you want to.
Once again, there's our show, Sarcastic Voyage. You can get it at our website, www.algar.com, AALGAR. We're posting what now? Tuesdays and Fridays?
For right now, through October and November, we're doing Tuesdays and Fridays. Then we're just, I believe, going back to Fridays. We're just starting, so we're trying to get a bunch out there and really, you know, get our legs. And as far as what we do, I don't know. We talk about crap. We're not as focused as Spike here.
Yeah.
We just kind of wander around aimlessly.
Mm.
But
if you want to follow us on Twitter, I'm at @RobotMatt.
I'm at Algar, AALGAR.
All right, so we're going to go into the closing here. Thank you for joining us here on TuneCast. There are several ways to get in contact with us or leave feedback for the show. The first is you visit www.geekcastradio.com and find all the other GCR and podcasts there. The second is you can stop by predaconempire.com/CafeSpark. Those are our forums. The third is you can leave the show feedback on iTunes. Yes, please do this. We crave feedback on iTunes. iTunes review whores.
And I don't even care. I mean, I'm speaking for me. I certainly don't want to speak for you, but I don't even care if it's negative as long as it's constructive. I mean, don't just say, hey, you suck. But I do enjoy getting the occasional, well, it was a slow start, but it was better here. And, you know, like people just tell me what you really think.
Yeah.
You know,
give us something we can work
form.
With.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
They're pretty good.
On my
it, you know?
Transformers review podcast, I had a guy basically review it like, after the fifth episode, and he's basically tearing shreds in his dumb bastard.
I actually wife chimed in when she was.
Okay, remember this funny when I was married to him. He's saying that on Twitter. The fourth is you can visit www.earth-2.net forums and find our shows or our threads for the shows in the self promotion section. And the fifth is the email address, which is gc.com. We now have a voicemail line. Call us and leave us your thoughts on each episode. Be sure to say which show you're leaving the message for and your name. The number is 502-526-5821. You can also follow us on Twitter. The show name there is GCR and Tunecast. Mine is TFG1 Mike. And you guys already said your Twitter name. That's fine.
Yeah.
We did. We're constantly
and you,
on Twitter.
Hey, folks, you're going to have to follow both of them because,
yeah.
They pretty much talk nonstop to each other and you won't...
All we basically do is bicker back and forth.
That's cool.
Yeah.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tooncast and wish you'll join us next time when we will be reminiscing on the Jetsons and the Flintstones. For now, I am TFG1 Mike with, and this is where you saying the real words of Optimus Prime, transform and roll out, and thank you for listening. Until next time.
Thank you all for being here today. I've called this press conference on behalf of myself, Ron Algar Watt, and my co-creator, Matt Robotham, to inform you that once the current run of our award-winning webcomic, Vengeance of the Interman, is finished at the end of this year, we are here. So we brought you here, and we will now take your questions.
Al?
Hmm?
There's
nobody here.
There's nobody here. Nobody read the comic.
Oh.
At all.
Oh. Well, we're doing a podcast now.
Yeah, we are doing a podcast now.
The Sarcastic Voyage Podcast. Available via iTunes or on the web at algar.com.
And then suddenly, everything would go black.
That's all, folks.
Well, how's that?
Oh, great. Great choice.
Pardon me. I don't mean to put a damper on this thing, but weren't there supposed to be 5 rockets?
There were 5, and I lit them, too.
Holy smokes.
Whoa! 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 Whoa!
Hit the deck!
Sam, speak to me.
Ooh, you carrot-chomping, flop-eared, bob-tailed rabbit. I hope your inners turn to outers and your ears go vice-versa. I hate rabbits. It's just human nature to hate rabbits. Why, you low-down, flop-eared son of a kangaroo. You'll pay for this, you dog-blasting, ornery, no-account, long-eared vermin. Why, you corn-sourned, idiot rabbit.
Yeah. Maybe we can fix it in the editing.
Is it lunch now?